Tom Bearden.
Yes, this is Tom.
Hi, this is Todd Hathaway, Leslie Pastor, and 1,523 viewers on Justin.tv. Good afternoon.
Well, very good. Very good, Todd.
Hello, Tom. It looks like this worked out. I'm glad you were able to schedule the time this afternoon to talk to everybody.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We have the summary of the topics you wanted to discuss, and I'm reasonably certain Leslie is better qualified to interview you than I ever will be. So I will hand the baton off to him, and if you're in a position to talk for 2 hours, that would be great. If you need to cut it short, that's perfectly acceptable. And there's also the option, did you talk to him about Bill and Carrie?
No.
Bill, Ryan, and Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot.
Yeah.
We're interested in talking to you about the Barcelona conference and some other questions, I'm sure. So following your presentation, if you're interested in talking with them, I'll try to bring them in on a conference call. It's entirely up to you.
Okay. Let me get through this thing, and then we'll see.
Exactly.
All right. See if my voice holds out today.
Okay. All right, Leslie. You and Tom, go ahead. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Hello, Tom. What would you like to start with first?
I beg your pardon?
What topic would you like to discuss first?
Well, we're going to discuss several topics today to be sure we have some fairly thorough coverage of what has to be covered.
Right.
I can give you a sort of a semi-listing of them.
Okay.
We're going to discuss the basic thing. We're going to be discussing physical reality and unified physics, but we're going to discuss energy in some depth. And we will discuss it all the way from suppression of Nikola Tesla and his discovery of systems that take energy from the active medium.
Excellent topic.
And we will discuss we'll mention Barrett's proof of that. We will then show you that what happened to take that out of normal electrical engineering in 1892. It was deliberately mutilated so it wouldn't be in there.
Yes.
And so they could cripple our electrical engineers. And then we'll tell you about some more crippling they did in 1900. And then we'll tell you a difference between Maxwell's theory and electrical engineering. We'll discuss that in general terms. And we will then go in some detail about how an electrical system is actually powered. It is not powered by turning the crank of a generator, for example. We will show that, and we will show what happens to the mechanical energy you put into the generator and what happens to it. It doesn't do anything to power your load.
Right.
And we will show how the load is powered and how that's been known in physics since 1957 with the Nobel Prize awarded to physicists, but it hadn't made it into electrical engineering. And then we will go into the difference between a symmetric and asymmetric system. This is out of the group theory. We've had group theory in our universities since 1870, but they don't teach the electrical engineer any group theory because they don't want him to know what was done to them. They do teach the physicist group theory, and so a physicist can tell you the difference between a symmetric and asymmetric system. But most electrical engineers have no idea what you're talking about, and they do not realize that their model was deliberately mutilated to reduce it to a symmetrical model in 1892, and we'll talk about that a little bit. So then we will talk about conservation of energy and momentum, and the fact that they were never taught that you can violate the conservation of energy and momentum law. That's well known in general relativity and physics. But electrical engineering is normally done with only a special relativity situation, and therefore you cannot violate conservation of energy and so forth. But you can if you know how to do it, and I'll give you some examples of how to do it.
Good.
Then we're going to talk about how you can apply a mechanism that's already been available in our university since 1967 when the Russians released it, that allows you to do this and how you could use it to make, for example, a self-powering steam boiler. And that, of course, then shows you you would not have to have so many power plants. You could simply replicate steam boilers, have one jump start another one, and one power plant could start all kinds of steam boilers. And the idea is that you can use the same grid we already have and not have to replace it or anything. You can use what you've already spent tremendous sums of money on to have it and just be able to take the power directly from your self-powering steam turbine. And then we'll talk about correcting some fallacies. In this day and age, it's kind of stupid that these fallacies still exist, but they do. For example, the fallacy that there's no such thing as perpetual motion. Newton's first law of motion is the law of perpetual motion, for God's sakes. Anybody can't read that and understand that, go to get out of college. So we will do that. And the fact that they say you can't violate the second law of thermodynamics, well, you can. There is no such thing as a second law of thermodynamics. There is a second law of equilibrium thermodynamics, the old, old stuff. And if your system is in non-equilibrium, you don't have to obey that old law anyway.
Right.
So it's even Maxwell knew this. It would be nice if our modern folks, electrical engineering, would learn it. And so the other thing we need to get across to them is that a common dipole is a steady source of free energy. It pours out steadily a real, honest-to-God observable photons and makes this field for free. So it'll do that once you pour force the charges apart and nail them down. If you leave it alone, it'll pour out energy from now till the end of time. And that's been known since 1957 in physics. So it'd be nice if we could get that into electrical engineering.
Sure.
And we will go into the business of negative energy, which, for example, Bedini has been using for 30 years and doing marvelous things with it. And it's in both Schrodinger's and Dirac's work, which is what tricked off and started all of modern quantum physics. But it so frightened the leaders of the physics community and the people that want to keep everything under control that they tore out brutally out of Dirac's theory in 1934. They tore out negative energy, not because they did anything scientifically. They did it to get rid of it.
Right.
They hated it. And I'll tell you why they hated it and what you can do with it, which is very startling. And then we'll give you the results of a very strong effort that's going on right now to restore this negative energy to physics, pointing out in all the leading physics journals that that original thing to rip it out had nothing to do with science. There was no scientific method at all. It was by frightening people that were scared of it and wanted to get rid of it. And we'll tell you why they wanted to get rid of it and what you can do with it. Then there's the, we'll talk about then something very fundamental. We'll talk about the structure of the universe with Dirac's negative energy and negative probabilities restored. And here we will give you some very startling things. And we will develop for what, for want of a better term, I've been calling precursor physics. The Soviets have it developed, but rigorously suppressed under their weapons program. And so we'll explain to you what it is and what you can do with it. You can directly engineer physical reality at will, and we will tell you the method and methodology that Dirac already knew in 1930 that would allow that to be done, if we would develop it. And we'll give you some examples of things that have used this process and some startling things that have been done and now certified in the hard literature. We will tell you how any object of physical process is actually being created continuously. We'll give you the exact process, and then we'll tell you how to engineer it and change it any way you want to, with Dirac's method, which is very simple and which is the way we ought to be going in physics. And we will then give you some self-powered systems, how to do some self-powered systems, how to build some,
good,
different things you can use to do it. We'll give you some examples like Floyd Sweet's vacuum triode amplifier, like the Fogel semiconductor that uses multiply conducted space-time, like our own little MIG, which uses the Aronoff bomb effect, which does not exist in electrical engineering, and like some of Bedini's work. Bedini has done some marvels in this area. We will give you some exact, you know, some absolute examples. So then what we'll do is, we, if we have a little time left, we'll try to tell you what's happening in the world today and why that all this affects, and why the Rockefellers, for example, have a whole underground city almost outside Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, where they plan to spend the terrible period that they see coming on at us, and where some others are too. But we'll try to give you an inkling of what could be going on to us right now in our normal life and what's headed down the pike at us. But the bottom line of it is, we can do free energy from the vacuum. Klimov's work at the National Laboratory, Los Alamos National Laboratory.
That's Victor Klimov.
And verified independently by the NREL, the National Recoverable Energy Laboratory. Two great national laboratories have verified it. And it proves you can build physical systems that take extra energy from the vacuum anytime you wish to.
Yes.
And this is in all the hard physics journals and in the nanocrystalline journals, leading journals of the world, it's already proven and tested. So these are basically the things we'll be talking about in this presentation.
Good. What do you want to start with first, Tom?
Well, first, let me just start off with a little foreword, and then I'll just go on with the whole thing.
Okay.
First of all, let's talk about physical reality. We got some funny things going on in our idea of physical reality. It's still medieval, what we're taught. It's all mechanical. You know, in the standard theory, vacuum, empty space has no energy at all, which is totally wrong in modern physics. It's the most energetic thing in the world, in the universe. But so we are taught still out of the old medieval textbook that there's nothing in the vacuum to give you any energy. It's just empty space and has no energy. This is what we really have to change.
Right.
If we do, we will then be able to solve the energy crisis. We will be able to cure any disease at will and very easily. And I'll give you an example. It's already been done and working right now, is working. And so forth. So let's get into this first and get back to the subject of where on earth things went wrong.
Very good.
Well, they started way back there. Let's talk about Tesla.
Yes.
Nikola Tesla was a genius. Remember, in the time we're talking about here, there was no such thing as a single electrical engineer in the entire world.
That's true.
It hadn't been born yet. There was only physics, and you had about three dozen physicists worldwide who knew a little bit of something about what was called electrodynamics and Maxwell's theory and so forth. So that was the situation when Tesla was doing his work. He wasn't trained in electrical engineering. He was trained in physics.
True.
And so he thought past where our electrical engineering is today, and the proof of his genius is the fact that he's the man who gave us the AC power.
Yes.
He's the man that gave us the rotating magnetic field inside your generators and motors that make them possible anyway.
Yep.
And he also is the man that invented radio. Marconi didn't invent it. He stole everything from Tesla, as upheld by the Supreme Court in 1943.
That's it.
The textbooks lie to you when they tell you Marconi invented radio and not Tesla. Check the actual court case in the U.S. Supreme Court. Don't take the word of the textbook.
Right.
Anyway, Tesla had stumbled onto, in his building of all these circuits and filing patents, he had stumbled onto what's called an asymmetric system. Now, let me explain what an asymmetric and symmetric system is. In the electromagnetic system, if I have a symmetric system, then I will spend, of the energy I collect in my external circuit, I will spend half of it to destroy the dipole in the source, kill off the source dipole that's furnishing the energy, and the other half I will expend in my external circuit to power the losses and the loads.
Right.
So this symmetric system, if you're building one of those, you're going to always have to keep pouring energy back in because you never get as much out in your load as you're having to put into the thing.
True.
So you're continually having to crank the shaft of the generator. And the asymmetric system is where you learn how to violate that, and you don't have to do that. You trick the vacuum, for example, into giving you the energy via your dipole or via charge, and you don't have to furnish it. The vacuum furnishes it in its ongoing interaction with a dipole or with electric or magnetic charge. Okay. Tesla had discovered these asymmetric systems and had actually patented two or three without using that term. And the proof of that is rigorously done by Terry Barrett. Barrett is a world-renowned electrodynamicist. He's one of the co-founders of ultra-wideband radar, which everybody said was against the laws of nature, impossible in theory. And people like Harmuth and Barrett proved it was possible and got it made after all.
Right.
The interesting thing was when all these super people were saying you couldn't do that, you could actually buy a little ultra-wideband radar on the shelf. It was used in a deep-poured concrete construction to find voids in deep-poured contract, for goodness sakes. And these folks weren't even aware that there was already an ultra-wideband radar system working and built.
Right.
So you got to understand you run into scientific oppression as well as, regular different kind of suppression where they want to kill you. But anyway, Tesla had discovered these things, and he was actively going around in the late 1880s and 1990 and 1991 and briefing leading societies like IEEE and so forth that you could have all the electric energy you needed and power. You didn't have to burn any fuel at all, no oil, no coal, no gasoline, none of that. You could take it all from the active medium. And remember, as I pointed out, Terry Barrett came along many years later and did a rigorous analysis in quaternion electrodynamics, which will show that if it's there, and showed conclusively that he had some systems that would do that. Tesla could do exactly what he said he could do.
Yes.
Well, J.P. Morgan and Tesla had destroyed he and Edison's dreams of a DC power supply, and they were going into fuel and stuff like that. So he was already set up to destroy Tesla, but he then said, we got to destroy this discovery he's made. And new thing they're fixing to put together, and they're fixing it up now, and they're going to call electrical engineering. He told his scientists, I want you to check that. I want you to be sure that it doesn't have any of those confounded Tesla systems that take energy from the active medium. We don't want any of that in that new stuff that's going to be taught in all our universities.
Right.
Well, as I said, we've had group theory in our universities since 1870, and all you needed was a good physicist to go in there and do a group theory analysis, and they did of the equations, which were the Heaviside equations that were going to use. Lorentz was fiddling with them to set up electrical engineering. And they came back and they said, Mr. Morgan, we got some bad news for you. We hate to tell you and to have to tell you, but those equations are still asymmetric. In other words, they do contain some of those systems that you don't have to put as much into them as you're going to get out.
Right.
And old Morgan said, fix it. So he did. Lorentz was a great scientist. I do not want to poo-poo his ability. But he had one characteristic that's well known, as pointed out by Jackson and Okun. He loved to take other people's work, other scientists' work, and publish it and take credit for it as his own. So they went to old Lorentz and talked to him under the table and told him they wanted those equations fixed. Piece of cake. He reached over and pulled out some work that had already been done to symmetrize those equations by Ludwig Lorentz, without the T,
right,
and published it as his own work, and it was symmetricizing Heaviside's equations, and they call those equations the Heaviside-Lorentz equations. Those are the equations that he turned over to those folks to use to set up electrical engineering. Well, now, this guaranteed... I want you to look at the mutilation that's been done here.
Right.
This guaranteed that every electrical engineer from then on throughout the entire world, as they learned to set them up and train them in the universities, was going to be able to build and design and think only systems which you had to put more energy in than you got out in the load.
Right.
They could only design and build symmetric systems. And so that's because their model was deliberately symmetrized, so they can't build anything else. In other words, it was done to the electrical engineers to cripple them forever. And it's still there, by the way, and they're still crippled. So they started in building, and everybody got used to building symmetrical systems, and you got to put the energy in. You always got to put in more than what you get out. And that's what we're stuck with today. The only exceptions they have for asymmetric is when they use a windmill or they use a water wheel or something like that to get some power from the current of water or current of wind. The problem is those are not that dependable and all that, particularly the wind, and they're very expensive and so forth.
Right.
So you're not going to solve the world's problem with wind power current power from water, because if you could do it that way, it would already been done. It's far too expensive. So what we got to have is something else. But anyway, they did make that change in 1892 is when Lorentz made the change and crippled electrical engineering, the new electrical engineering not even yet born. From its very birth, it was crippled and mutilated, and it was a noose tied around the neck of every electrical engineer so he couldn't do the job. That's the problem in the world energy crisis. It isn't all this stuff everybody's talking about. The problem is electrical engineering has been and still is deliberately crippled and deliberately mutilated. We've got to change that, because over in physics, we've long since had better systems of electrodynamics in that model. We've got quaternion electrodynamics, we got U1, we got O3, we got all kinds of stuff. You can get higher group symmetry electrodynamics that do permit all that. And by the way, they tell and lie to the electrical engineer and tell him he has studied Maxwell's theory. He has not. Most of them never even read Maxwell's theory. Maxwell's actual theory is 20 quaternion-like equations and 20 unknowns.
True.
And those things prescribe lots of asymmetric systems. You can do all kinds of things with Maxwell's actual theory the electrical engineer never heard of.
Right.
So it would be nice if they would teach him Maxwell's theory and let him apply it. Because then we'd very soon, within 2 years, these bright young fellows we got would give us solutions to the energy crisis. We'd never have it again.
Can I ask you to clarify one point? John Ambrose Fleming, he was instructed, he was taught directly by Maxwell. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you. What was that?
John Ambrose Fleming was the only student taught by Maxwell.
In those days, scientists didn't have funding and all to their universities and all like they do these days, very seldom at all.
Right.
So for funding or anything, they would usually have to go out and hire out to seek to being employed by some rich industrialist like J.P. Morgan or like Edison and so forth.
Right.
Fleming was the main consultant to Edison,
right,
and therefore to Morgan, who was backing Edison.
Right.
And so they got some use out of Fleming lately. What they really did do with Fleming, particularly when Marconi came along, there is a letter that has been published where Fleming writes to Marconi how to go about deliberately bypassing and tricking the patent examiners and all regarding the previous theory that he was trampling on there and take credit for it himself. In other words, how to bypass Tesla's work. That's what caused that Supreme Court hearing in 1957.
Yep.
Is that right? Is that the right year? I'll think of it here in a minute. Maybe it was 43. 43. Anyway, if you go to that Supreme Court hearing, all this is sitting right there in this court hearing, and the court found conclusively that Tesla invented radio, not old Marconi, and Marconi used Fleming's advice and all to actually deliberately try to cheat Tesla out of his own patents.
There's actually a reference to all this, Tom. It's a book called From Marconi's Black Box to the Odeon by MIT Press, 2001, page 72, by Hong Sun-guk. It states, in his letter to Marconi on February 19, 1901, Fleming reassured him by saying that Tesla could not do anything and that if you can receive there in America, you will establish priority. Hong, 2001, page 72, comment. This establishes that Fleming was knowingly connected with suppressing Nikola Tesla by 1901 and, in fact, was in a contact with Marconi to advise him. Marconi in trying, Marconi in trying to bypass Tesla's actual patents and prior art. When Marconi later tried to bring lawsuit against the U.S. Army Signal Corps, he lost. Tesla had already demonstrated priority art. Unfortunately, Tesla had already died 6 months earlier, so he wasn't able to be a beneficiary to the lawsuit.
That's correct. And unfortunately, as you probably have noted, most of our textbooks taught in universities still say that Marconi invented the radio and that they try to picture Tesla as being a sort of a comic character.
Right.
But Tesla was a great experimenter. See, he was working this stuff out when all of it hadn't been worked out before. There were no models when he was doing all those experiments and all. He was having to find out the basic phenomenology himself.
Tom, if I could just interject here a moment. Most people do not understand that this was all novelty of fact information, DC current, AC current. In fact, if you look at early pictures of New York City in 1908, people were still riding horses and buggies. You had very few cars. And this is right. New York City that Tesla had come to and that Edison was working in. In other words, this was rudimentary stuff. This was brand new, brand spanking new, and they were applying it. They were experiencing it firsthand.
That's correct. Now, another thing happened very shortly thereafter, after that 1892 mutilation of the model that was going to be used to set up the new thing called electrical engineering. To old J.P. Morgan's absolute shock, Heaviside, suddenly discovered that in addition to the Poynting energy flow pouring out of the terminals of a generator, the Poynting energy flow gets diverged into the external wires to potentialize the electrons and power up the circuit.
Right.
That in addition to that Poynting energy flow that does get diverged, there was, in fact, an additional flow that was mind-boggling, but it was in curled form.
Uh-huh.
It was several trillion times as large in magnitude as the Poynting component.
Right.
But being curled, if you're in a special relativity situation, you don't ever wiggle your frame. The divergence of the curl in special relativity is zero, so it doesn't diverge. It just roars on off into space and is lost and doesn't react with anything.
Uh-huh.
But the blunt truth of it is he discovered that every generator and every battery in the world is, was, and is still pouring out trillions of times more energy than anything we put in.
Right.
But most all of it is in this so-called unusable curled form.
Uh-huh.
So when he discovered this, when this got to Morgan's attention, he said, oh, my God, we can't have this being taught to this new thing that's now being set up as electrical engineering, because if you teach all those sharp young fellows that's going to be coming down the pike that a generator and a battery pours out gobs of energy more than what they have to put in to charge it and all, sooner or later, one of those clever devils will find out how to tap it and use it.
Right.
So you fix that to where that they don't ever get taught that.
Mm-hmm.
So they went back to Lorentz again. Remember, you can talk to Lorentz under the table. And old Lorentz reached up in the sky, absolutely no science, no nothing, and pulled out a thing that he taught everybody. He taught them to, first you've got to take your energy flow vector, which contains both those components, and you got to integrate it around a closed surface that you visualize around any volume element of interest. Well, when you do that, the part that don't diverge is positive going in, it's negative going out, so it just cancels. and it leaves only the pointing component that does diverge in the wire. So that very neatly zeros out this huge, heavyside, trillions of times bigger curl component. And so he published that method of doing that, and the reason he gave was because this curl component can have no physical significance. And if you'll check Jackson's book that's used widely in all our universities, you will find Jackson still admits that you can add the curl of any vector flow to the pointing component, and he uses the same words that the other guy used. He uses, but it can have no physical significance. So our engineers are not aware today. They're not taught and not aware, and they would poo-poo the notion that a generator pours out several trillion times more energy than we account.
That's
taught to just throw it away and ignore it.
Right. That's J.D. Jackson.
Yes, J.D. Jackson.
Reviews of Modern Physics.
Yes. And so he's one of the great classical electrodynamicists of the world, and his books were widely used in our universities as good textbooks.
Right.
So anyway, the thing is, we have a situation here where what we're saying is they have rigorously suppressed the idea and the knowledge that we're surrounded by so much energy pouring out of a system anyway, we don't know how to catch it and what to do with it.
Right.
There isn't an energy problem. There's an energy catching and use problem.
Right.
But the energy is there in unbelievable things. A single generator pours out enough energy to power the whole United States.
Yep.
So all we have to do is go back and undo that old medieval stuff they're forcing down the throats of our electrical engineers, bring them up into a more modern model that does include all of that, and then get them on it. And J.P. Morgan was afraid of,
right. They
will very soon get on to it and find out how to do it experimentally, and pretty soon you'll have some equations telling you how to do it.
Right.
So this is what we need to do. We need to use the horsepower we already have instead of continually trying to keep information from them and keep them crippled.
Right.
So anyway, that's the thing on the system. So, well, we just discovered something else. If a system, a generator or a battery is sitting there pouring out far, far, far more energy than what we're putting in, for example, by cranking the shaft of the generator, where's that energy coming from?
Good question.
And how are you getting it to pour out of there? Well, let's go into that.
Okay.
First of all, let's talk about what cranking the shaft of a generator does. Let's follow that, because everybody's been taught false,
right,
deliberately in the electrical engineering book. When you crank the shaft of a generator, you put in mechanical energy that rotates the shaft. And courtesy of Nikola Tesla's discovery of how to do that, that made that possible,
right,
you use the conversion inside there and making of the rotating magnetic field right there inside the generator. Now, all the shaft energy you crank in gets translated and transduced into rotating magnetic field energy right inside the generator.
Right.
Okay, what happens to that rotating magnetic field energy? It doesn't pour out the terminals out in the external circuit at all. What it does is it forces the internal charges, it forces opposite charges apart. It forces the negative charges in one direction, positive charges in the other, and that makes a source dipole. That's all it does. It escapes from the generator when it does that.
Right.
So all in the world that cranking the shaft of a generator does is make you a source dipole. Well, what does this source dipole do? Well, since 1957, you see, over 50 years now, and the Nobel Prize awarded to Li and Yang, we know that a dipole is a broken symmetry.
Right.
A proven one. Well, broken symmetry means Lee points it out very nicely when he says, talks about when you have a broken symmetry, something that previously was virtual has become observable.
Right.
So what it means is the dipole continually absorbs the virtual photon interactions it's ongoing with the vacuum. Tremendous set of interaction, incredible energy.
Yes.
And it adds up some of that to observable size and pours that out as the real energy we see pouring out of the dipole in our instruments measure.
Right.
because now they're not virtual photons, they are observable photons, they're quantum sized.
Right.
So that's what a dipole does. It takes energy directly out of the fierce vacuum interaction that it's boiling in, and it converts some of it into real, honest-to-God, steady flow, and out comes a flow of observable energy we can measure with our instruments. But it comes out with those two components, you see. It does a lot of it. Most of it is non-diverged in a normal action. Most of it is that heaviside giant curl component just roars on out into space and is lost. A tiny bit of it is not curled, and that's the pointing component, and that diverges into the external circuit to power the electrons.
Right.
Well, now that's good as long as you have a special relative situation, which is all the electrical engineers are taught. Now, if you come along to general relativity, if you can make a general relativity situation, then the divergence of the curl does not have to be zero because your frame changes, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the frame changing and how you can violate conservation of energy, because most people don't believe that, and they won't even believe it when you tell them and point it out that it's already known in physics.
Okay.
And you quote Roger Penrose and, you know, Sir Roger Penrose and eminent scientists like that, and Nobel Prize winner. They don't believe it.
Right.
Actually goes on there. If I'm looking, I'm sitting in one frame. My frame I'm sitting in is called a lab frame, and I got my instruments set up to accurately measure, and I put in a flow of energy to a system here, to something that I'm measuring, and I measure it very accurately. Suppose I measure 100 joules per second going in there.
Okay.
And if I measure it again, I get 100 joules. If I measure it again, I got a steady flow going in there. Well, if I rotate my frame a little bit in one direction, I rotate it, and then I just as accurately in this new frame measure that exact same situation that's going on only now in a new frame, I only get 50 joules per second going in. It's the same thing, but now it only measures 50 joules. Now, if I rotate my frame the other direction, past where it was in my original lab frame, and stop it over there and measure over there, I can now find that I moved it to a place where it measures 200 joules per second going in.
Okay.
Here's the point. When I say we have 100 joules per second flowing into something, I'm talking about in a specific frame. I actually have situations going on in the universe at large and all these other frames where that's any number you wish it to be, from zero to almost infinity. We see, that's not taught to our electrical engineers in school, and they're taught to avoid any mention of general relativity. But in general relativity, you are not limited to the conservation of energy law and momentum. That applies only to one single non-rotated frame.
Okay.
Well, what's the use of going into that technical nonsense, or does that have any practical use? You bet your life. In 1967, the Russians used what they call a go test. They like to see if Western science is still stupid, because they've been working on all this stuff for lots of years. They got a lot of things worked out.
Right.
So in 1967, they released a process which will do something with some of that excess energy by using rotated frames. Quite simply, they built it, since we want to use energy here, they used a conductor that little spherical particles that they charged with a certain amount of charge on them, and they were set and designed exactly so they go into self-oscillation at the exact frequency you input a laser beam to. So they're synchronized exactly with the laser beam. Well, a very strange thing happens when you do that. This thing absorbs, if you do it right, it absorbs in the frame one time where you only have to put in a small amount. It releases over there and when you're in the other frame where it's a large amount, and the damn thing puts out 18 times as much energy measurable to you now coming out of that self-oscillating thing, input section, coming out of there is 18 times as much energy as you're paying to put in. Because it's a general relativity situation, and you're not having to conserve in one frame, you see?
Yes.
So, well, now, wouldn't this be useful? You could power the world with this alone. Well, They reacted so fiercely against that. The optical physicists in our universities every year perform experiments doing this and have a COP of 18. They're not allowed to say it has a COP of 18. They're not allowed to say excess emission. They have to use the mind-boggling phrase, negative resonance absorption of the medium, blah, 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 which doesn't mean anything but excess emission of the medium, because it's general relativity when you use it and you're putting out more than you have to put in. But they don't allow you to say that. They say that's negative resonance absorption. And then what they say, they don't allow you to say it outputs more than what you put in. You have to say it increases the reaction cross-section. Well, isn't that a nice set of junk? We got in every leading university with a good optical physics department. Every year we're doing over-unity experiments with our laser optical people that are COP 18, and they do not allow them to tell us what they're doing in plain English.
Right.
They have to use this tortured phraseology that nobody knows what it means and pretend that it's not putting out more than what you put in. It is 18 times as much. Take a look at the literature.
Right.
So this is how our own scientific community will suppress information. It's embarrassing to them. They don't want to change.
Right.
So if they hadn't discovered it and hadn't thought enough in general relativity to go through and understand it, they're going to tell you, you can't say COP greater than 1, and you can't say excess energy emission. You have to say negative resonance absorption.
Right.
But anyway, we're talking about things that are well-proved, and the final clincher is, of course, the work of Klimov and his crew at Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Right.
Klimov built a little solar cell, a very tiny one, out of a nanocrystalline material. And if it's made tiny enough, which they can do, it acts different from a normal solar cell. A normal solar cell, you hit with a photon, spits out an electron. But Klimov cell, you hit with a photon, it spits out an electron, but which immediately dives into the virtual vacuum down below observable level and then pops up with lots of energy on it and falls apart into several electrons, 2 to 7.
Right.
So it comes out with 2 to 7 times, 200% to 700% times as much output energy as you put in.
That's phenomenal.
Now, this is proven and replicated in two great national laboratories. It's in all the leading physics journals of the world now, and in the leading nanocrystalline journals. It's known, except it isn't known in power engineering and electrical engineering. And they won't tell our electrical engineers about it, because they tell the electrical engineers, you can't hang, there's no energy in the vacuum, and you can't take any energy out of emptiness.
Right.
So that's the stupid situation we're in. Even when we do it and prove it, even since 1967, they won't let our guys use it. And any physicist that tries to tell them what's really going on, they'll crucify him.
In fact, Klimov's work is actually referred to as energy from the vacuum.
That's right.
By a leading science journal.
Now, let me tell you what you could do with Klimov's work. There's another little phenomenon with tourmaline. A tourmaline crystal has a very nice little characteristic. A tourmaline crystal, a little bitty tourmaline crystal, is like a little battery. It has a plus side and a minus side.
Right.
And it never loses it, but it continuously pours out real photons. Wait a minute now. This thing self-pours out energy from now to then. It's like a self-firing battery. It's well-known in literature. You can check it out. But they don't know what to do with it. Well, let me tell you what to do with it. You take a little tourmaline crystal and put it in the center of a spherical shell of little tiny Klimov solar cells.
Right.
It's radiating photons in all directions, and you can design it to where you get them in the near infrared, which would be useful. And then Klimov's little solar cells around it will pick up these photons coming in, and each one will give you an amplification of from 2 to 7. Let's say you get 4.
Right.
So all around you might get an amplification of 10 or 16.
Okay.
So this little shell that you make is that consists of the solar cell of Klimov surrounded by a spherical shell of these other crystals. that of the tourmaline surrounded by the Klimov solar cells.
Okay.
This will give you, you could build a device that actually gives you self-powered, it's taking it right out of the vacuum, you don't have to put anything in it once you get it in there.
Okay.
You could build a solar panel that doesn't have to have sun shining on it. Wouldn't care whether the sun is shining, darkest midnight, down on the bottom of the ocean, or out in deep space, could care less.
Right.
It'll radiate and keep right on radiate, taking this energy right out of the vacuum. You could build a self-powering unit with no problem, and the proof of every bit of that is already in the literature.
Right.
Replicated and valid, the main part validated by two great national laboratories.
Exactly.
So what on earth is wrong with our scientific community? But anyway, this is where we're actually at if we would put it all together and get some things going and quit pretending that we got to use this old 1892 and 1900 electrical engineering. We can use other things to do other things. Okay, if you were to use this, you would have self-powering systems. We talked about using the basic approach to make a self-powering steam boiler. Steam boiler's got heat. If you design it in the infrared, where it works in the infrared, that's heat. It's furnishing photons. You could have a situation where the photon amplification of Klimov cells is used, and so this thing would have a gain, let's say, a 4. You could achieve about a 4, which means you could tap off one part and leave the other 3. You'd have, still have an amplified heat going into your a steam boiler, and yet the thing would be self-firing on the heat input after you got it cranked up. Then you could disconnect any electric power or anything to it, and it's self-firing. Once you get the self-firing boiler going, it'll power the generators that you hook to it, and they'll power their lines. But you can also take off a line and jump-start another self-firing steam boiler and another and another. You only have to have one power plant ever so often. Just a very, very few for absolute reserve, and power everything by self-powered steam boilers.
Right.
The stuff to develop it is right now. They're in the literature waiting on somebody to do it, and we look like we have no idea how to proceed or anything like this has even been done.
Right.
And so, but anyway, that's one thing we need to do. We need to build these self-powering steam boilers because we have one heck of an enormous investment in this power grid. And if you use a self-firing steam boiler, you conserve your grid. You use the grid you've already paid to go into all the homes and everything. And so it's a lot cheaper to go that route than it is trying to build these heavy old windmills and all that stuff and then not be able to depend on the wind.
Exactly.
The vacuum never runs down.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one thing we would want to do. We would want to build self-firing steam boilers, and that would take over our power grid with just very few plants, and we would dramatically reduce the burning of coal and all of that stuff, and you don't have to burn the nuclear power and all that. Get rid of that dirty stuff.
Right.
And we could clean up the biosphere.
Nice.
A great deal. But we got to go to our new physics, not to 1902 and 1892 and a 1900 old electrical engineer put together before modern physics even came along.
Exactly.
None of this existed when they put it together. You can't blame them because all of this other stuff didn't exist.
Yep.
So anyway, we now know that we could build these systems if we would. Let's talk about Schrödinger and Dirac's work with negative energy.
Okay.
They have negative energy in there, and as we said, when the control groups got through looking at that, their scientists had shocked the daylights out of them because they saw that led to the ability to directly engineer physical reality. Let's speak about how that works.
Okay.
If I hold in my hand a glass, standard old water glass that I drink water out of, made of glass, and I say, when was this glass made? Everybody will say, well, it was put in a mold and the mold pressed it. That's all the mechanical changes of it. No, when is the glass actually being created? Well, the fact is, it's being created instantly there in your hand in that molded form and everything, that shape and everything else. It's a set of ongoing virtual particle interactions down in the deep vacuum
Okay.
That add together, you know, form higher level components and structures, and then they form higher, and pretty soon they hit the quantum threshold. Now you've got observable stuff. You've got atoms and nuclei and protons and electrons and all, and you're going up into the matter universe. But everything is actually continuously being created at a very high rate right out of the virtual state vacuum as I hold it in my hand.
Right.
Wouldn't it be nice, then, if I could engineer that? Say I look at that glass and I say, you know, I had dreams of royalty. I want to be drinking out of glass made out of pure diamond. Oh. Well, if I could add into that ongoing set of stuff, if I look at it with Dirac's full theory with a negative energy back in there, I have structures of positive and negative energy and probabilities going a very deliberate structure making that glass, that specific kind of glass. Yeah. If I could tailor that negative energy at will, spruce up some of it over here, some of it take out over there and all like that, if I could tickle the vacuum, I could do that. Dirac pointed out the method. And I could adjust that to where that turns to whatever I want it to turn. You know, turn it into a structure, ongoing structure for whatever I want.
Right.
And all you have to do is the vacuum. I want to talk about this process because it's very important.
Okay.
I want to talk about the vacuum itself. Okay? The thing that's wrong with our old medieval concept that we're still hanging on to, that vacuum is emptiness, it is not. It's a plenum.
Right.
And you have to write yourself the equation that virtual particle flux of vacuum is identically what we call space-time, and it's also identically what we call energy. As you know, Feynman and other folks have pointed out that in physics today, we still don't have a legitimate definition of energy. Well, I just gave you one.
True.
It's pure vacuum, pure boiling virtual particle flux of vacuum, and it's pure energy and so forth. It's also your physical reality. Structures of that makes it structures of your physical reality, mass, energy, and so forth.
Yeah.
So how would you engineer that? Well, Dirac knew this in 1930. In his theory, with a negative energy applied, when you have what's called the Dirac C. The Dirac C is a vacuum looked at as consisting of hidden electrons, electron holes with an electron buried in them.
Right.
And if you use a little sharp little pulse, a little tiny pulse, you can pop out the electron and leave the hole. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go together. The vacuum has a charge of zero, and now you've removed a negative charge from it. So it has a charge of that counters that. And so it had this hole has a charge, and you've subtracted minus one from zero, and so you got a charge.
Okay.
The other thing you've done is this charge is pouring out energy. It turns out it's a negative charge, and it's pouring out negative mass energy. You got to look at the mass energy.
Right.
You remove positive mass with the electron, which means this hole has negative mass energy. And so it's not a positron, as they told you it was, with positive charge and positive energy. It's got negative energy, so it's got to be some kind of crazy negative charge or something we hadn't named yet.
Right.
But anyway, it does put out negative energy fields. Negative is continually emitting negative energy photons.
Uh-huh.
And it's negative energy. That is the dark energy that all our physicists are looking for and can't find, because when they ruined the Dirac's work way back there, they tore it out of physics and threw it away.
Right.
And then the dark energy they're looking for is just that negative energy pouring out of that stuff. But all you have to do is, Dirac pointed out, when they tore it out to get rid of negative energy, he pointed out to them, well, you can do that okay with the normal conventional stuff, classical stuff. You can't do it with quantum stuff because when you make a little pulse on a vacuum, you leave this vacuum hole, and it's got negative energy.
Right.
You can't get rid of the negative energy. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you take the vacuum that something exists in, like this glass in my hand.
Right.
I put it in a little container that's just snug and all, but it's the vacuum that it's sitting in. Now I tickle the vacuum with a lot of little tickle pulses.
Right.
These tiny little EM pulses, all that I've done thousands of experiments to work out the patterns that do what. And I can change that into anything I want. I change it into diamond, and I look at that, and I say, I don't like a diamond after all. I'd rather have pure gold. And you change it in there. I was connected with Bedini when Bedini actually transformed copper into gold. It is doable, and Bedini chases the pulses.
Right.
He's been doing a little bit of Dirac-C tickling for something like 30 years.
Uh-huh.
So you can do this, and it does work. But anyway, the water dash process that everybody keeps stumbling into and going to all kind of lengths trying to explain, the best one to start with for ease of explanation is Professor Kansas's water dash process.
Okay.
He noticed that he was using a pulsy technique to cure cancer, and he noticed that it affected salt water in his lab.
Right.
So he began to experiment with it, and what he found out happened is it causes the water to start breaking down and the water molecule to start losing a hydrogen bond, OH bonds, and break down into hydrogen and oxygen gas.
Right.
And so as the gas bubbles form, that's because they're in a tickled vacuum, they won't explode because you can't hardly form, you can hardly form an OH bond in that area. Now the tickling prevents it, so you try to burn them inside there, they won't burn.
Okay.
But if you pipe them outside into the combustion chamber of an internal combustion engine that's not in the tickled vacuum where you're making the hydrogen and oxygen bubbles,
right,
then you've got just a normal hydrogen oxygen mixture, and it'll burn and smoothly out your exhaust. Will go nothing but water vapor.
Tom, let me...
Well, we cannot junk all our cars right now. Forget the thing they're having in Copenhagen and all that junk. We cannot junk all this money everybody spent on his cars. They can't afford it.
Right.
We have to be able to clean up the use of those cars and gradually replace that with a better car, electric car that takes it out of the vacuum or something.
Right.
But to do that, we need to be able to cleanly use the present diesel and gas cars, and you can with water gas. Kansas turned that process over to one of the world-renowned water chemists of the world.
Right.
He did every test known to man, 50-something tests he did on that thing, very rigorous. And he sort of said when he finished, I can't tell you how it's doing it, but I can tell you what it's doing, and it's doing exactly what he says.
Right.
So it is certified, and it is available if they would pick it up and learn what the mechanism is that we have just covered.
If I could...
It's Dirac-C vacuum tickling.
Tom, if I could just interject a second. People that are listening in, they could actually Google John Kansas. That's K-A-N-Z-I-U-S. And they could actually see this being performed by him. It's recorded. It's on the internet. Yes. Sorry, Tom.
All of this can be checked. Everything I have said so far, there are references for him.
Right.
And the list is well aware of the references, so...
Right.
He's done a bit of checking. You don't take the word of somebody that jumps up and starts talking about this stuff unless you check him out.
Exactly.
And he's checked on what I'm talking about, and he knows the references are there. He can certify they are.
Exactly.
And so, but this, if we would develop water gas, or we would have some hacked off big oil companies and big control groups because we just took a lot of money away from them, and the Middle East wouldn't like us because we don't depend on their oil anymore. But if they won't let us drill our own oil and use it, which they won't, we could be burning water in all our vehicles, and they're clean, no carbon in those that exhaust at all.
Exactly.
And so we could clean up the biosphere real good, way past what they're talking about in Copenhagen and want to charge us a lot of money for,
right,
so they can break us economically. But the thing is, it is doable. It has been done. It is working on the shelf right now. And there's a patent filed on that, and I guess Kansas's widow has probably got the rights to it.
Right.
Somebody ought to put it into production.
True.
And so there's one that would allow us to salvage all our present fleet of diesel trucks and gas engine cars and trucks and all until gradually we can replace them later on with better. But we wouldn't bankrupt everybody all of a sudden by saying, either you're going to have to change your car for a $25,000 or $100,000 car here that we'll be on now, or else you're going to have to go bankrupt and pay us big money for because you're running that car you're running.
Okay.
We've got to beat that. That's stupid. So anyway, that's one other thing it needs doing is water gas. But we can do it if we use Dirac-C tickling and we understand that it gives us the ability to engineer physical reality. Now, what we have said, let me give you some more examples of the process. In your body, all your nerve dendrite endings are spiking all the time.
Right.
Little bitty spikes, you talk about a system of voltage spikes, boy, you are. And everything living is. Every animal, every fish, every jellyfish, every what else.
Right.
And every once in a while, for example, a human being is born with a little excursion from the normal genetic pattern, and he varies in his capability of controlling his spikings.
Right.
Every once in a while, one is born that has much better control of his spikings. And let me tell you, this is where the legend of the miracles and all that comes from. These people can stand there and directly engineer the physical reality of their surviving. Some of them can.
Right.
I stood beside Doyle Noyes in Kansas City, Missouri, some years ago. Doyle was one such fellow. And Doyle, at high noon, bright sunlight, not a cloud in the sky, it hadn't rained a drop in 60-something days, terrible drought. At high noon, Doyle turned the sky dark as midnight, formed huge boiling clouds with great lightning bolts and torrential rain in them, right there in Kansas City and nowhere else. And I was standing 4 feet from him when he did it. Now, at the same time, there was all these dark cars, probably up to about 20 of them or so, that had guys in dark uniform, wearing dark clothes, wearing dark glasses and bulges on their coat from their machine guns, chasing Doyle, trying to kill him. And old Doyle would point his hand at one and flip it over. He'd point his hand at another and run it off the road. He was giving them heck. But they were trying to kill him because I call this kind of person that's born that can control his wiggles and therefore do precursor engineering of physical reality and do miracles directly. I call this precursor engineering. And Doyle could do precursor engineering himself by controlling his own wiggles, his own dendrite endings, spikings of them.
Right.
And so, but they have for years, at least 100 years, the control groups have personally worldwide run down these kind of people and killed them. They eventually killed Doyle. Took them a while, but they eventually got him.
Right.
All you need is one sniper shot and you got him. So one good sniper shot that he wasn't aware of was going to happen to him. So they eventually killed him some years later, but he survived several years by whipping it on them all the time. And but you see, our normal statistics and our normal probabilities of excursions from the standard genetic model tells us right away that these people are born. Did you ever see one? No. Because they don't want one to be available to our physicists to study, because if he did, sooner or later, our physics community would stumble onto precursor engineering, and there wouldn't be any such thing as control over people anymore anyway.
Yes.
So this is the thing. They've been suppressing that kind of thing for at least a century and killing off all over the world these 10 sigma people that are regularly born. Now, what about a 10 sigma animal or 10 sigma jellyfish? Well, it turns out that about 1990, a tiny little jellyfish, about half the length of your thumbnail across,
right.
This little jellyfish was born with an excursion where he could control his spikings of his nerve dendrite endings a little better.
Right.
Well, what he used it to do was to reverse aging. This little thing then quit dying of age. You can kill him physically by tearing him apart, but he doesn't die of age. And they have put this thing in leading biology labs now, the whole world, and observed this, certified beyond belief, printed in all our biology journals, and accepted, known in biology.
Right.
This little thing, what he does, he's born. He goes through a juvenile stage and gets to puberty and has his offspring. He then starts to age, and his body stops aging. And then it reverses from aging back to unaging and all the way back to an early juvenile stage. It turns back to an early juvenile body gradually. And then he lives another life cycle, stops, goes back, lives another one, another. They've observed this going on ruthlessly in the biology labs. It's printed in the leading biology journals of the world. It is now known and substantiated scientifically.
All they have to do, Tom.
So this is flat true. This jellyfish does this. So if we could control our wiggles, or if we could build systems where we applied the wiggles, the tickling that we need, we could reverse aging. Right. Nobody has to die of aging.
Right.
Let's talk about Kansas's process for curing cancer.
Okay.
Kansas was interested in cancer cure because it's a bad disease, affects a lot of people, and kills a lot of people. And he himself wound up with cancer and died of cancer.
Right.
So he was trying to find a cancer cure. Well, he started playing with these tickles, these Diraxi tickling we know now, to put it more especially. He was playing with precursor engineering, didn't know it. So, but anyway, what he found was that if he tickled a cancer, look at when cancer grows in some tissue. Here's a terminal tumor. It's going to kill this body. It grows in some tissue. It's the last energy thing that happened. It's the highest energy thing that's happened going on.
Right.
So that part of the body there is being created all the time by these processes we were talking about, the precursor engineering processes. The last thing that it has created was to develop this tumor. If I just add some negative energy and write a little tickle pattern there to it, I'll unhappen the terminal tumor. I'll take away that extra energy, and it'll just start to slowly disappear and vanish.
Okay.
Now, they've taken his cure for cancer, and it is being developed by a standard, known, legitimate Cancer Research Institute. Several months ago, they completed their phase one animal test.
Okay.
Where they took bunches of animals and they put terminal tumors, I'm guaranteed to kill every one of them.
Okay.
And they put them in there and they did the tickling. Ha! They had one of the most unusual phase one tests that's ever been done. It cured the cancers 100%.
Okay.
It didn't move or lose a single one.
Right.
So this shows you that if we worked out the exact tickle pattern to use for a specific disease and learned to use it, then our scientists, if our physicists worked out the precursor engineering and did the experiments, thousands of them for those tests,
right,
we would gradually accumulate a catalog of practical technology. We could take a disease, any disease, and unhappen it. It just gradually ceases to be, just gradually go away. You don't have to take harsh drugs. You don't have to beat on them. You don't have to cut on them. You don't have to do nothing. As a matter of fact, it goes further than that. If we had a little child born with two heads and one body, like happens every once in a while, we could do a proper tickle pattern and rectify it. We could either have two heads and two bodies, or we could have one head and one body, whatever we wanted that to go to. But we could cure everything. Everything physical and every physical process is open to direct engineering if we but work out the method. They don't want us to know that, which is why they suppress that out of Dirac's work. And so what we're sitting in now is we're sitting at a time when the people that are looking at that jellyfish are all biologists. So they're looking over in cellular biology, looking for a mechanism that the cells are doing. That's not what it is at all. It's a physics mechanism.
Right.
If they would run some physicists in on it who would understand precursor engineering, take the time to go back and put that negative energy back into Dirac's theory. And by the way, there's a group of very, very good physicists, very strong physicists under Dr. Daniel Solomon, who's the dean of a college of mathematics and physics at one of our leading universities. They realized that that had nothing to do with science, taking that negative energy out of Dirac's theory, so they have a very strong movement trying to get put back.
Right.
Because they're pointing out we can't even claim we're practicing scientific method if we just tear something up and throw it out deliberately.
That's North Carolina.
It's in the equations. We've got to put it back in there. So we're hoping that gets put back in, and then maybe we'll turn some physicists loose. Well, the control groups don't want that to happen.
Right.
So depending on how you want to think about it, they're going to take steps to see that it doesn't happen. Well, how would you do that? The only way you can do it in a free country is it's not free anymore. And everything we look around, I don't want to dwell on this. Les is the expert in the suppression and the control groups problem, and I think he's already briefed you on that pretty thoroughly. But what they're doing is they're applying it to totally destroy our dollar and destroy us economically. And my God, we've run up more debts here in a few months than all the rest of the presidents have run up in their whole life, in our whole history of existence in the United States. And so we got some terrible things coming down the lab at us, because when you lay a debt like that on the back of the taxpayer, the only way you can get it is by taxes. So somewhere they got to start taking enormous money out of us to try to pay that stuff that they've run up and gave us as debts to bail out the big guys who did the bad stuff.
Right.
So what we have to do is we have to beware of that. That's still coming at us.
Right.
When they start hitting us with those taxes, those high taxes to pay that.
Most people, Tom, if I can interject a second here, we were talking about Tesla before. Most people are not aware that Tesla was actually murdered to prevent him from accomplishing what he wanted to accomplish. I went to a primary source to ascertain the truth of that, and I actually emailed Adam Frumley. Here's what he emailed back. Most people may not know who Adam Frumley is, but he was an associate of R. Buckminster Fuller, and he provided me with first-hand primary source reference pertaining to his experience at the University of Toronto in 1981 via private email. Here's what he said. This was sent to me Wednesday, December 10th, 2008, and he was referring to Tesla's death. Yes, in 1981, I was a speaker at the first international conference on novel energy technologies held at the University of Toronto. After a very warm ovation, I was approached by many individuals, as always happens at these events. One individual claimed to be a former New York City Police Department detective. He was in his 70s. He said that one of his first cases as a detective was the investigation of Nikola Tesla's death. He said that at first it was assumed that Tesla had died of old age, but that he had found a note in Tesla's hand that said simply, "I have been poisoned." He went into some detail regarding the rather primitive forensics available at that time. He did say that Nikola Tesla was definitely murdered. But when he and a fellow officer tried to pursue the investigation further, the feds waltzed in and took over. He said all the public was allowed to hear was that Tesla had died of natural causes. Although I do not at this point recall the gentleman's full name, he did indeed provide identification. He also had an old beat-up leather briefcase of the accordion variety from which he pulled a very old-looking file regarding the investigation he had done and several other related issues. As we were standing there, another gentleman approached to introduce himself. Interesting to note, this individual was a captain in the United States Naval Intelligence who later became one of my handlers. I had no idea at the time who he was, but I have always wondered about that interruption. He was very curious about what the detective had been telling me. Meanwhile, the old detective excused himself and moved rather quickly out of the auditorium. That was the last I heard from him. And that was from Adam Frumley directly to me. So that's a verification that Tesla was murdered with an investigation done by the actual detective who was there. Sorry to interrupt you, Tom.
No, that's fine. I'm glad you put that in, Les, because that's true.
Okay.
Let's talk about this suppression methodology, because they have been suppressing inventors who, just with thousands of experiments, gradually crawl their way into how they can evoke phenomenology on the bench and in systems, and gradually learn to control them.
Okay.
And what they've been working out is really asymmetric systems, so they can have over-unity systems or even self-powered systems.
Right.
And they've been killing them off in all kinds of suppression techniques. So let's talk about some of the suppression techniques.
Okay.
One of them is to kill him directly. Stan Meyer, for example, finally got water gas right, and he would have been able to put that thing into production. And so apparently they got him. It depends on who you say as to what his last words were. He was either poisoned or they hit him with a special kind of shooter I'll talk about a little later.
Right.
But he is one that definitely was killed and recognized that they were killing him and ran out saying, you know, they were killing him.
Right.
Let's talk about the Jim Watson motor, because I was directly involved with this and I know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Watson worked with Bedini directly for a long time and for quite a while, and Watson was a very brilliant guy on the bench. He was also a young Bedini, so to speak.
Okay.
And Watson came up with a self-powering generator that ran off a battery and kept charging its own battery. But it was 8 kilowatts in size, big thing. And it would power itself and power an 8-kilowatt load.
Mm-hmm.
And at one of the conferences, free energy conferences that were given in those days, this generator was taken there, and actually they demonstrated the generator.
Yeah.
Jim demonstrated his generator, which worked fine. And they had told the companies in advance that we're going to do this. You send your own engineers there if you wish to, with their own test equipment, and after this is demonstrated to the audience, they'll be given several hours where they can test this thing absolutely to their heart's content and verify it or falsify it.
Right.
So they did that. They checked it from stem to stern, several different groups of engineers with their own equipment and everything. When they got through, they certified it was working.
Right.
Well, not too long after that, Jim was married and had some little children and, you know, had a nice young wife. He loved his family. Some nice dressed gentlemen appeared at Jim's door carrying a catalog case and dressed in suits and ties and everything. And when he came to the door, they said, "Mr. Watson?" He said, "Yes." They said, "Mr. Watson, you are now working for us. Here in this catalog case is $5 million in cold cash for you. You don't ever have to report this on the income tax or nothing. That's all taken care of. This is yours to keep. You will have a very good life. You're going to be paid a handsome salary. You will work for us. Your unit will be built and used, but it'll be used by us. It'll never be on the world market. But as of now, you belong to us and you're working to us. Now, Mr. Watson, if you don't like this, if that's not acceptable to you, when we leave right now, your wife and children are going to be very dead and so are you. What's your answer?" "Well, what would you do if you were a young fella and you got a nice young wife and you got some lovely young children you love dearly? You're not going to sacrifice your wife and children."
Exactly.
So, of course, he went with them. Well, the answer is he's still alive. His unit is in production. It's used several places in this country that are hidden. And it's used at least in a couple places in Germany and at least one place in Switzerland. And so, yes, he's still alive, and they did exactly what they told him. He works for them. He has a handsome salary, drives a nice sports car and all, but that's it. He had to break off contact with every friend he had. And so that was the story of Jim Watson. It actually happened. Okay, let's look at some other suppression means. That was an exceptional one.
Okay.
Of course, there's the direct assassination. Some of them they just kill. That varies everything from a sniper to more exotic forms. Let me talk about another form. There's an ice dart dipped in curare, and let's just say that I know something about that weapon and leave it at that. But anyway, this one, the ice dart is dipped in curare. You fire it, the powder never goes, stays in the gun, so it's confined in the barrel. It's explosive. You've got to handle it later. But the ice dart with the curare is propelled into the body of the victim. It's a short-range weapon. The victim goes down kicking and screaming and floundering and everything and promptly lays there and dies of seizures and everything else. And the curare breaks down in the human body, and if it's long enough before they have the autopsy, all it shows is he died of some kind of massive seizure or stroke or something like that, and so it's labeled a normal death. Now, do I have some personal involvement with this? Yes. When I was working with Bedini, and when he made that gold out of silver, out of copper, we had one of the real agents, all-time big active agents of the control groups with us to suppress John. And they were kind of stupid. They thought I was the brains of the outfit and John was just the bench worker. That was not true. I was learning from John Bedini.
Right.
You see, he was part of my teacher. So I was learning from him is what was going on. I wasn't the guy that it was coming out of his brain at all. But anyway, they came back and one day and told us, you guys have to give up this copper thing in the gold right now. If you don't, you'll be dead in 24 hours. Just say no and that's it. You're dead. The other thing is if either one of you takes a trip in 60 days on a train or a plane or a bus or anything, you will die. You have my promise on that. And said, Bearden, we may kill you anyway. Like I said, they mistakenly thought I was the brains. Instead, it was John. And if we do, we'll tell you how it's going to be done. It's going to be done with a nice dart dipped in curare. Well, see, the dumb fellows didn't know that I already knew about that. He even knew the inventor of that little trick. So, anyway, I knew about ice darts dipped in curare. Well, 64 days later in my normal job, I had to make a trip down to El Paso for my job. I took a government PhD with me, Dr. Kelly. We went down, did our business, coming back and changing airplanes in the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. Of course, it's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and everybody changing planes. It's real busy as heck. Crowds of people walking everywhere, and they still had the phones on little shells out there right where you walk. Now they got them over back on the wall.
Right.
But you could just turn aside into a little, between two little eaves and pick up a phone. There was a whole line of phones there and started falling. So the guy ahead of me got off the plane. I have no idea who he was, never met him before in my life. He turned off and was picking up that phone and starting to talk on it when I stepped past him. The moment I stepped past him, he let out a yelp, strangled yelp, and hit the ground kicking and flopping and everything. I jumped with my back against a post looking. I never saw who fired the shot, but he kicked and flopped, and his eyes almost popped out and everything, and died right there at my feet on the floor. And so it was a nice dart dipped in curare.
Okay.
And when Dr. Kelly came out of the restroom, I said, Dr. Kelly, I want a witness here. I think this fellow had a heart attack or something. He had some kind of seizure because I've just watched him die.
Right.
Kelly leaned over him and looked at him and said, he looks dead as a doornail to me. So I said, let's get the heck out of here. So about that time, here come the emergency people. But they killed that poor individual just because he was a convenient target in the right place at the right time to tell me and convince me they really meant business. And show me they wasn't kidding. Well, I knew that already. So, but that's the kind of people they are. They don't care who they kill or how many or what. Kauai Motor. When we started out some years ago, we met Kauai. He came over from Japan. And I talked to our group here. We all met with him. And Kauai already had. We saw what he had. And he did me a great service. If you understand the Japanese etiquette, he brought his original motor over to show me.
Uh-huh.
That was a real treasure for him of where he started. And if you understand the Japanese psychology, he was paying me the deepest kind of respect. I've a third dan in Aikido, so I understand that.
Right.
And so anyway, we talked and got along well. And he came back a second time and he said, I want you guys to put this thing together and produce it. I've already got its rights in Japan. It'll be produced there by somebody else. But you will produce it worldwide. And I said, Mr. Kauai, you've already got the motor and everything. Why do you need us? He said, you don't understand. He said, back during World War II, he was a child. And they were all told that when the Americans took over Japan and came in, that we would slaughter them en masse. We were just going to kill them off by the millions. And they were prepared to die. They thought their death was sealed when we took and occupied Japan. Instead, to their utter astonishment, we started getting all the roads fixed and putting people back to work, working on the power lines and everything and cleaning up the rubble and got everything moving and working again. And his parents, who were from the old school, called him in and said, Kauai, we have incurred a great debt of honor to the U.S. If you ever have a chance to pay that debt back, you must do it. We are honor-bound because they could have slaughtered all of us like pigs, and they didn't do it. They treated us like human beings, and we owe them a great debt. And this was Kauai's way of repaying the United States, for goodness sake. So unless you understand Japanese etiquette, you won't understand, us Americans won't understand that. But it makes good sense, to particularly to an old-fashioned Japanese. And he already had a self-powering motor in Japan. So we had meetings with him and discussed it, and he was going back and send us over a self-powering motor. And that was a Thursday that we reached the agreement. That night, a private jet arrived post-haste from Los Angeles with a Yakuza, Japanese mafia, on board. And you haven't lived until you've sat across the table from these guys with the impassive eyes that never blink, tattoos all over them, and a finger missing here and there they've cut off to appease the bosses, and very cold eyes looking at you. And so they informed us that they had captured the whole Kauai party. Kauai couldn't even lift his head. He looked like a broken man. Couldn't even look at us in the eye. He no longer controlled his invention, his own fate. His little president had a private meeting with us and told us that they were talking about whether to kill him here in Huntsville or kill him on the plane, throw his body out, going back to Japan over the ocean, or allow him to go back to Japan and live in dishonor the rest of their life, which is what they did. But anyway, the next morning they packed the whole Kauai group up in the plane and hauled them out of Huntsville and hauled them back to Japan, and they stopped the Kauai motor and its production and dissemination around the world. They stopped it cold turkey right there. Now, I was directly present for that. This is not hearsay, and I got plenty of witnesses, one of who's sitting right here with me right now, that was sitting in the room looking at those people with the tattoos and the cold eyes and the missing fingers and all that. So it happened. Another thing that they'll do, they'll divert you onto other things. The standard thing is they'll just divert you. If you're easily diverted, they'll divert you off into anything. That was what they tried with Bedini. John Sajeka came in and showed him this process, left 20% of it out to make copper into gold. What he didn't know, John already knew the 20%. So John promptly made it, and the next morning when he saw that John had turned copper into gold, it almost flipped him out. So, but one of the things they'll do is give you a little bit of something, but not quite all of it, and get you diverted chasing something you never finish. Right. Another technique they use is they use a throwaway assassin. I've had two of these, and the guy sitting with me is a witness. The first kind is the old rough kind, and he's very harshly treated. They use torture techniques and break him down to a shell, and then assemble him back piece by piece, mentally, so to speak. He's a walking automaton, but he's also a permanently terrible involvement in his autonomic nervous system. You can tell him because his eyes are wide and glaring. They show white above him all the time. Well, if you go in a restaurant, you're sitting down, and they bring in a guy with his eyes glaring, and he can't seem to do nothing else, and he sits down looking at you, it's going to take him about 10 minutes to burn that image in his mind so he won't forget you. He's not real functional. But then what they'll do the next day, he'll come in where you're eating, and he'll bring a pistol. They'll just turn him loose, and when he spots the target and recognizes, he walks over in front of you, blows your brains out, sits there, the police come, doesn't move, nothing. You can't get anything out of him. Yeah. So we had one of those that got handled. And then we had a better kind, is the more modern kind is favored by the Mideast folks. It's where they use a little, not quite so harsh measures, and he's still a throwaway assassin. He's the kind to kill Robert Kennedy, but his eyes are not glaring. They're very keen when he looks at them, but they don't show white. So if you got a guy comes in, he has to fixate about 5 minutes, and if he fixates it on you for about 5 minutes, he doesn't waver in looking at you, you know what's going on. So you call somebody, and they're waiting on him. So this one happened to us. The next day, we were very ready for it. I have a legal permit to carry a weapon if I need to, and I've carried quite a few times. And I had my weapon with me hidden and was going to try to survive if I could. Well, nothing happened. And about midway through our meal, through the back alley comes a very athletic young man, about 30 years old, special forces type, kind of. And he comes through the kitchen, looks out the door, and he catches my eye and Ken's eye and catches me looking at him, and he blinks and winks his eye at me and smiles and nods his head and clucks like that. Walk back out. In other words, it's taken care of. You don't have to worry about it. Okay. So that was the second one of the kind that killed Robert Kennedy. There's all kinds of poisons they use. They use some that break down very fast after they kill you, so the autopsy does not find the poison. They do all kinds of ways that they can do for you. And then another thing they do is they sick all kind of people on you that have knee-jerk reactions. For example, if you do anything in this kind of area or anything, you're going to have a lot of people that are blog experts and never done anything, never worked on the bench or worked with anybody on the bench, and they'll be telling you all about it because they know everything, and they'll just hate your guts. So what they'll do, they'll call up one or more of them, and they'll say, "Do you know what that dirty old Tom Bearden said about you?" And he'll say, "No, what?" And they'll say, "He said so-and-so." "Why, that dirty SOB." And the next thing you know, you got this guy all over you. He's on the phone. He's knocking on your door, everything else. So they sick all kinds of people on you to, like that that are easily diverted. So there's all kinds of techniques, but that shows you some of them. The other one that I wanted to cover was a Venus technique shooter, which is a standard assassination tool. It's well known in deep intelligence circles worldwide, but it is not known outside those circles, and I'll say no more about that. But the Venus Technique shooter, what it does, it consists of a beam that is made of wave fronts that are highly warped. And it turns out that if you get hit on the body with a beam of electromagnetic energy in the right frequency to be absorbed by your body, and it's got these warped wave fronts, what it does, it totally destroys the ability of the body to control your heartbeat. So your heart suddenly is totally out of control. It goes into wild fibrillation. If you don't get out of that beam in about 10 seconds, you're going to die of a massive heart attack or something like that.
Right.
So we've had one of those. I even saw I had seen at some meetings in Washington. I saw him open his pocket, open his coat, and he had the thing sitting in. He had the small one sitting in his coat pocket. It's about the size of a pocketbook. It'll fit in there. And he had a wire on him to ground him so it wouldn't hit him. And he pointed the thing directly at me from about 20 feet away, and immediately I started having all kind of fibrillation. I knew exactly what it was. If I hadn't known, he'd have killed us. Ken got a little of it. He was sitting with me. He got enough to shake him up. But as good luck would have it, we were sitting right beside the emergency exit of this restaurant here in Huntsville at noon. And I grabbed Ken's arm, and out through that door we went, setting off all the alarms in the building and everything else. But we got out of that beam in less than 10 seconds, and so we lived. I have a friend in Australia that they use the bigger one that's about the size of a bazooka, and they carry it around, and it's got an infrared component with it. They can see your spot on the outside of a building, and they can shoot you up on the second floor when you're sitting in the room in there. So they killed a friend of his, and they actually saw the guy putting the shooter back into his Jeep and roaring away. So he killed one in Australia. But anyway, the Venus technique is a standard shooter, and it appears to be what was used on DeJesus up here in one of our international laboratories in North Carolina on airports. DeJesus was from a wealthy Netherlands family. DeJesus had worked out a process like we were talking about with the tourmaline crystal surrounding a little shell, surrounding the something like this nanocrystal in the middle. He'd worked out something similar to that, where he had a self-powering solar, what we would call a solar panel normally, but a self-powering cell. And he needed funding, but he was from a wealthy Netherlands family, and he was, when he told them what he had, they knew lots of investors, wealthy people in the Netherlands, and they said, you tell him to get over here and sign his contract quick. He's got all the funding he needs. So he was getting on that air. He was going to catch that airplane to go back and get his funding and put that thing into production. Not everybody is dead who worked with the jails. I'll say that and say no more. Sure. But anyway, he had a legitimate one. He could have put it into production. And so when he was parking his car, he suddenly had this massive heart attack. All he had to do was drive up by the car and stop, pointed at him. He couldn't get out of the car, couldn't get out of the beam. Holding on him about 10 or 15 seconds, they had him dead. So that's probably what it was. It was probably a Venus Technique shooter that killed the JS because it stopped that project cold. So there's one more that got suppressed. And they go on and on and on. Many, many, many inventors have been suppressed. Fogel Semiconductor is a miraculous thing. It's a special semiconductor, even has a patent on it. What it actually does is when you let it simmer down with a low input, it let it loaf along with about the third or fourth the input that it can handle or it's designed for, it'll settle down and start directly controlling space-time itself. It starts directly shaping space-time. Well, now, that gets very interesting because one of the things it can do is access multiply connected space-time. A multiply connected space-time is one that you can be sitting here and have a spot on my door handle, and there's a spot on the door handle over in Berlin, let's say in an office over there, that's directly connected to that and a zero distance between the two.
Right.
If you were to step there, you would step through that one door and step out the other door with no travel in between. Now, that exists in certain countries in their what's called off-budget deep black ops programs that they've developed technology that would scare the hell out of our physics professors in our universities if they knew about them. All major countries of the world, modern countries, have certain developed technologies that, again, would scare our universities and physics to death, but they're all carried with no mention of them at all. We don't really buy $800 hammers on our government contracts. We buy $8 hammers, and the other money funds the off-budget black ops folks. Enough said. I won't say any more about that. But every major nation has them. People like Israel, Russia has lots of them, so forth. And so there are technologies already in the world that would scare the hell out of the average university physics staff completely had they any knowledge that those things had been developed and existed, and they work. Well, Fogel demonstrated his ability to do instantaneous communication in several laboratories around the world, one U.S. government laboratory, one over in Europe, a rigorous laboratory, one by Southern Power Company, and all kinds of things. And he's continued to be suppressed for over 20 years and hadn't got it out yet when he has one of the most miraculous inventions the world has ever seen. So I'm hoping one day that he gets it out because you can build free energy devices with it real easy also. There are all kinds of things there, but that let me talk about the Floyd Sweet vacuum triode amplifier. Floyd went into the nucleus of the barium atom in a barium ferrite magnet and found a way to cause that nucleus to go into self-oscillation. Well, the nucleus is negative energy. Binding energy of the nucleus is negative energy. They hate to tell you that in physics anymore, but it's true. Well, that means that if he was getting his energy out of that, the energy density is also tremendous, much more than what we're used to in fields outside. His unit had to put out all negative energy, and I verified this on the lab bench, and it had a gain of 1,500,000. So you put in minuscule energy, you got out 1,500,000 more, but negative energy. Now, negative energy has got some nice attributes. You add load, you get more negative energy. Energy comes from the surrounding vacuum. In a normal circuit with positive energy, it's always trying to escape back to the external environment. The negative energy is trying to escape into the circuit from the surrounding environment. So just add more load and you get more negative energy. So I designed an experiment I'd been thinking of ever since I got my master's degree in nuclear engineering at Georgia Tech, how to do anti-gravity. But I never met anybody who had enough gain to do it and had negative energy. But he did, and so I got him to double the gain and put this thing on the bench and added in, he had 500 watts for his output to use 100 watts and switchable intervals to add to it. And I designed this experiment to do for anti-gravity. That would build it up enough to clearly show reduction of weight on the bench. So he did that. I wasn't able to afford the trip. I was short on cash, so I couldn't afford the trip out there to participate. But I was on the phone here in Huntsville, and he was on the phone out there doing the experiment, and he read the results on the phone to me as he did them. So, and as you plotted it, I was plotting it here on this end, it lost very smoothly. It lost 90% of its weight sitting on the bench. But I warned him not to go any further because if he did, he could explode those magnets. They go off like hand grenades when they do, and they'll kill you like a fragmentation grenade. Well, just before Sweet died, I, by the way, got a paper published in a conference where I included the results of the Sweet experiment and put his name on the paper front because he was the inventor, not me, and that was appropriate. And we did get a publication with the results of that experiment in it and generally what was done. But just before he died years later, after all the crooks and everything had moved in on him, Sweet called me up about a week before he died, and he said, "Tom, I meant to tell you one other thing. I sat there, even though you warned me severely not to add any more load to that thing," he said, "I was so stunned by it that the more I looked at it," he said, "the more I had to do something." So he said, "I looked there about 3 hours, and then I decided I was going to risk it if I blew hell up." So he added another 500 watts and switched it in 100 watts at a time, put it on a tether string that he tied to the footpost of a bed, and when he cranked in more load, that thing rose up smoothly to the end of that tether and hovered up there, held by the tether to the bed. He looked at that a while, and he put another rope on the front of it and pulled it down on that edge. And when he did, it would fly around, say, clockwise on the end of its tether string. If he pulled it the other direction up, it would fly back around in the other direction. He said, "I wanted you to know about that before I died because I'm old and I'm on my deathbed. I'm going to cash in my chips." And he did. He died about a week later. So he did the anti-gravity experiment. Well, you see, I wasn't too surprised, because his mentor was the great Gabriel Krohn. If you will check Gabriel Krohn out, you will find out that Gabriel Krohn had a negative resistor, a true negative resistor, in the 1930s at one of our major universities. And he worked on a U.S. Navy contract. And I'll shut up because the work never stopped. And I'll just shut up and leave it alone at that. But anyway, Floyd was directly connected to the great Gabriel Krohn, who had him sent to MIT to get his degree. And Krohn was his mentor and really liked Floyd because Floyd was a real brilliant student. And he did later succeed in a practical anti-gravity device himself that could have been used to give us anti-gravity for free. The reason is, when you produce negative energy, it's the exact opposite of positive energy. Two positive energies attract one another gravitationally. Negative energy and positive energy repel one another gravitationally. And so it acts just backwards, you see. If you're producing lots of negative energy, it's repelling all the positive mass energy in the bench and the ground underneath you, and it's trying to levitate above you. So that's the way you build a practical anti-gravity machine, is just like he built his. That's one you need to know about. Our own MEG is fairly simple. We simply use the Aronoff-Baum effect, which does not exist in electrical engineering at all. It's one of those totally outside electrical engineering. But if you have a toroidal coil, will form the Aronoff-Baum effect. If you confine the magnetic field to the core of a toroidal coil so that it can't escape out and pour out into the surrounding space, Then in that surrounding space where it would have poured out, there appears a free A potential, absolutely free, free energy. You change the energy of the surrounding space. Now, if you will put a little pulsar in there where you pop out a little E-field pulses, a little disturbance pulse, magnetic field pulses out there to that A-field, you get a very strange effect. When you perturb that A-field, there's a little formula that says dA dt is equal minus E. It generates an E-field going back the other direction, back to the thing that from where the perturbation come. So if you put a little perturbation coil in there and perturb it, you can get back to that coil from every direction around it, free energy. If you establish a procedure where you get some coherence in that return energy, you can get usable free energy output with it and go over unity. That's the secret of the MEG, real simple. The Aronoff bomb effect is not in electrical engineering at all, but has led thousands of physics experiments with it. It's validated in all kinds of literature and everything. There's all kind of different variations on it and everything else now, the Berry phase and all kind of stuff. So it's a well-established effect. It really is there, and it really can be used. We just found a transformer-type core that would do that confinement that was made in this nanocrystalline layered plate. One of the things in the suppression of the MEG, when GE came in and bought the was going to buy Honeywell to stop them from funding us to develop the MEG, an interesting thing occurred. The first thing they did was destroy that division of Honeywell that furnished those very reliable cores. They turned it over to some Japanese outfit, sold it off, and that Japanese outfit gets their cores from everywhere, India, Pakistan, and you can't find two that'll do the same thing. So if you're going to restore the MEG, you're going to have to redevelop your own source of dependable cores, because they deliberately destroyed our source. The sources are still there. You just have to develop one yourself and buy only that coil from that producer to be sure it would do that core. But it still could be done. By the way, J.L. Naudin in France independently did build a MEG, and his unit worked and worked fine, and Naudin has verified that independently of us. He has no connection with the MEG, and he has no interest in the MEG and no financial interest. He has no connection with the MEG group, the five inventors that invented it. But he independently verified it himself, which to us is worth pure gold, you see, because he's independent of us.
True.
You don't have to take our word for it. Go ask J.L. Naudin, did his work, and he says yes. But he built it right. You can't just throw some old parts together and get yourself a MEG. It doesn't work that way. So that's another thing we need to do. Well, we've covered a lot of ground. I want to do some summary now and talk about what it is we need to do in this old world.
Good.
Well, we're in a terrible process. We're going down the tubes economically. Everybody sees that. They're going to convert us back to feudalism if we're not careful. Four states have already signed decrees back to the federal government that they're not recognizing their authority in that area because they're violating the original constitutional agreement.
Right.
And some more are considering that, so maybe we got a rebellion going. I don't know. But anyway, we need some results, and we need them as fast as they can humanly be done. Well, first thing we need is an energy solution. They're not going to let us drill our own oil and that sort of thing and use that. We're going to have to, you know, do all this other thing and fund it and tax us to death. So the first thing we need is some free energy devices. We've given several that will be directly appropriate, particularly the self-powering steam boiler for our industrial process and all, greatly reduce the amount of the number of power plants we got to have. We can get rid of all the nuclear power plants, all the nuclear waste and all. And by the way, we can clean up those more than 1,300 reservoirs of pure gunk, pure dirty gunk that's at our coal-burning plants alone. We can clean every one of them up and turn it into pure water if you want to, if we would develop precursor engineering, the direct engineering of physical reality using Dirac C vacuum tickling. That's doable, and we can do it and totally clean all that up. We can clean up our whole biosphere if we develop the precursor engineering. We can also easily cure every and any disease, reverse aging. Everybody can be young and vigorous and not an old, feeble guy like I am. And so they can be young and vigorous and live a good life, and there's no reason for your life to live unless you have an accident or somebody kills you. So we could do that. We could change and improve and clean up our environment beyond anything anybody's talking about today. We never would have to burn all this coal and oil and all that again. We could clean up all the nuclear waste. They have no solution to that today. Don't believe what you're told. They have absolutely no solution. The Russians, for example, don't worry about a solution. They just take it out and dump it in the ocean. Well, that's going to poison the ocean sooner or later. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to do that at all? So you can get all that out. You can convert all our trains and ships and airplanes and everything else to the use of something besides gasoline and diesel or nuclear. You can convert them all to very clean burning, very clean power systems. And in fact, if you use a little precursor engineering, you can build systems that just radiate the power. You can have like a self-made dipole anywhere that radiates whatever you need as long as you need it. I mentioned, or didn't mention, one thing I wanted to point out. You can power a system off static voltage alone. Suppose I have a source of voltage connected to an external circuit, but clever devil that I am, I'm not going to accept any current. I'm not going to allow current to flow in that external circuit while I potentialize the circuit. So holding the current back is called pinning. There are quite a few different ways of pinning in literature. You can look up any of them. It's this there. So you pin the circuit. You can pin it for, you know, a millisecond or 2 milliseconds easily. And any common switcher, good switcher today, can switch in a microsecond. So you can potentialize that circuit. The potential travels at essentially the speed of light. And you can potentialize all those electrons in that external circuit while they are immobile. They're not moving as current. There is no power. But the energy is stored in the external circuit free. No power revolved because all you did was switch a little bit. And so, you know, your volts is defined as so many joules of energy per collecting coulomb of charge. If the charge is sitting still, it still collects, it's still potentialized. So you can potentialize your external circuit without current and without power, and then switch away your source and close that empty gap with a diode to cause the current to can flow in only one direction and a resistor loop. And then that potentialized circuit, when it comes unpinned, it will discharge and kill its own dipole, but it will discharge the collected energy half to kill its dipolarity and half to power your loads and losses. And then you switch again and again and again. And all you ever take from your source is static voltage. Something like that is exactly what Jim Watson was doing. And if you do that, you can build an asymmetric circuit that does not have to expend as power half its energy over in the internal circuit to kill your source dipole. You don't have to do that at all. So we could be powering most of our circuitry with static voltage anyway. If we would put this into electrical engineering and modernize it since it's 1892 and 1900 mutilation. And then as we went on and developed precursor engineering, we have physical immortality against aging looking at us. We have water gas looking directly at us easily. We have cancer cure and disease cure looking at us. And if we'll stop them killing the 10 sigma people that are born, our scientists will have them to study, and eventually we can all learn how to do that ourselves. We can work out procedures for teaching a person to do it. For example, Dr. Jack Houck, who's retired now, but he was a professor, from a noted university. Houck was interested in metal bending back when Uri Geller was popular and so forth. And he gave hundreds of metal bending parties where he taught people how to bend metal. And I attended several of them, Doris and I both, my wife and I both attended. Interestingly enough, that the main one we attended was Jack Houck. He also got 80% of the people able to bend metal that attended his parties. And interestingly enough, both Doris and I bent metal, and our metal bent both at the same time exactly. Synchronized together. So, but Jack has an established record, proven record, hundreds of experiments scientific experiments where he achieved 80% ability of getting people to be able to actually bend metal in their hands, holding a fork by the tip end of the handle and watching the tines just bend every which way, see? Or holding a knife by the tip end of the handle and watching the knife blade just fold over double. And so when I used to work with Andrea Pujarić, there was a lady who worked with him occasionally that could bend any time she wanted to. She stood up at a fancy table in Europe one time with all the swells there who were poo-pooing things like bending metal and all when Uri Geller was famous and traveling everywhere. And so she said, "You want to see metal bend? Here's you some metal." She reached over and picked up a handful of silverware and rubbed her hands together on it, threw it out in the center of the table, and the stuff lay there just bending right in front of them every which way in the direction. And then she stormed out of there, tired of those folks. But it does, it is real. It is there. It's waiting to be developed. But it is physics. It is not chemistry. And it's not biochemistry to do the healing. It's a physics mechanism. If we'll put the negative energy back into physics, the mechanism is there. If we would pursue these matters, which the control groups do not wish us to pursue and do not intend to let us pursue, if we would pursue these, then we would have no want. There wouldn't be any starving children in the world or children dying of diseases, hard diseases, and their parents dying of every filthy disease in the world. Once in Haiti, I decided to see with my own eyes exactly how the Haitian people live, the common, ordinary, poor people. I walked about 6 blocks off into the slums. And the sights that I saw, I will never forget as long as I live. For example, I saw little children 6 and 7 years old. Their parents had been killed by opportunistic diseases. Nobody caring for them or nothing. Scrambling through all the garbage, trying to find any scrap of anything to eat, starving. Little frail bodies. And to drink water, they had an open sewer with human excrement floating on the top of it. And they would drink water directly from this open sewer. And I looked at that with total consternation. It tore my heart right out of my breast. And I said to myself, we have to do better than that. We can do better than that, and we have to do better than that. And so my final message to everybody is the world that we have allowed to be built around us and hold this free energy away from us and hold this precursor engineering away from us, this world that we have been given that is so restricted and limited and mutilated in our theory and in our science, if we would change that, we can eliminate all that. We won't have those hungry little children, millions of them worldwide dying right now as we're talking, adults too. We won't have starving people. You need to feed somebody, you can feed them raw off of desert sand, change it into food. Don't have them desert sand, change it out of pure vacuum. It's all doable. The gist of every bit of it is in the textbook if you'll put it together and restore the physics and get on with it. And so my final fervent plea to the entire scientific community, the governmental community, and to everybody that's in a position of authority to see something done about it. Don't build more big windmills. Don't build more dams. Go after free energy from the vacuum. Go after the Klimov process. Go after Bedini. Take a few $1,000,000 out with Bedini and power the whole world real easy. How would you like 40 different kinds of systems? Bedini can do it. There are other inventors that can do it. Go fund them, protect them, don't let anybody hurt them or kill them, and then get this stuff out on the market and eliminate this long suffering from humanity. And, by the way, eliminate all the control of the control groups. So that's my presentation for today, and I thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Excellent. Bill and Kerry from Project Camelot will be attending the Energy Conference in Barcelona in February. And are you still online? Tom?
Yeah, I sure hope you have success.
Would you be willing to take a couple questions from them?
No, I'm going to have to. I've talked way past where I'm supposed to talk, so I'm going to have to shut up.
Okay.
But I did want to release this while the release was good, at least the gist of it. Liss is well aware that just about everything I said can be checked. The references are there. You can find them.
Absolutely.
And so the thing is, I wanted to point out the overall picture and the main pieces of it.
Okay.
But I will have to shut up or, you know, if I want to stay and do well, too.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time out this afternoon.
Thanks, Tom.
And we'll carry the baton wherever we need to take it to succeed.
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Good night.
God bless you.